This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, is Medicare set to be front and centre of the coming federal election campaign again, with Labor promising to end the rebate freeze? And brutality in the UK. Brexit plan is a mess. The Prime Minister hangs on by a thread. And the Tory party is in open war.
Everybody knows now that the Prime Minister's departure from Number 10 is absolutely guaranteed.
She has at least the right and the dignity, they owe her that, not to behave like they've behaved today. I think around the country there'll be real disgust at the behaviour of some of our cabinet ministers who are not fit for their positions if they behave like this.
But first, in the United States, it's showtime for the Mueller investigation. The claims of Russian collusion in the 2016 US presidential election have thrown a shadow over the first 2 years of the Trump presidency and threatened its legitimacy. A letter summarising some of the conclusions of the highly anticipated investigation has just been handed to lawmakers. The Attorney General, William Barr, has been studying the findings of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Kremlin meddling in the 2016 election and allegations of collusion with Donald Trump's campaign. The President's already responded and we'll bring you that shortly. First, let's hear from our North America correspondent, James Glenday, in Washington. James, what's the latest?
The latest is that we have this four-page report from Attorney General William Barr, which was sent to lawmakers just a short time ago. It's effectively divided into two parts. The first deals with Russian interference in the 2016 US presidential election. It details some of the Russian government's efforts to sway opinion via social media. It details some of the Russian government's hacking efforts. But the most important part is one line which says that the special counsel's investigation did not find that the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it conspired or coordinated with Russia in its efforts to win that 2016 US presidential election over Hillary Clinton. The second part of the report deals with whether or not the president has committed a crime by obstructing justice during this investigation. On this, the special counsel did not make a ruling. It put out some evidence on either side and spoke about difficult issues of law and fact and what the president's intent was. Its final conclusion was that the special counsel does not conclude that the president committed a crime. It also does not exonerate him. On that point, it was left to the Attorney General to determine whether Donald Trump had committed a crime. Donald Trump's hand-picked Attorney General, he has concluded that the president has not committed an obstruction of justice offence and says that there's not enough evidence to prove it because it cannot be proved that the president was acting with corrupt intent because he wasn't found to have tried to interfere or collude with the Kremlin to win the election. So it is certainly a very, very big development here in the United States.
All right, James, the big question, though, will Donald Trump's opponents and his Republican colleagues be satisfied with this response?
No, they're not, and they're making their views known as we speak. The most important thing, I guess, to point out with all this is that this is the Trump administration's Attorney General's summary of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's final report, and that the main threads of the final report. It's not actually the special counsel's words that we are seeing. And Democrats are demanding to see not just the conclusions by Robert Mueller, but they also want the entire report as well and the evidence behind it so that the public can make up their mind. And on that, I think we're shaping up for a very, very, very big political debate here and a tussle over how much information is and will be released.
All right, you've said it will be released, but at what point? What can lawmakers actually do to get access, get their hands on the report?
Well, they have a few options. They can take this to a court to try to force the Department of Justice to release it. Perhaps a more high-profile way of trying to get information is to subpoena the Attorney General William Barr and get him to testify. Democrats are already saying that they are going to do that to try to get some information surrounding the background to this decision. In particular, they note that it took 22 months for the special counsel to carry out its investigation, and yet it's taken just 48 hours for the Attorney General to look it through the report and say, no, there's not enough evidence to push ahead or charge. There's not enough evidence of that the president has committed an obstruction of justice crime. They could also subpoena the special counsel himself and get him to give evidence, perhaps even in a televised situation in Congress. So they are some of the things that I think Democrats are seeing. But it has to be said that the president and his allies are absolutely thrilled with this. They say that this is effectively as good as it could be. Some are even complaining it is saying that it could be seen as a complete exoneration.
All right. Our North America correspondent, James Glenday in Washington. And as James just said, the White House is thrilled with this report. Let's hear from Donald Trump.
So after a long look, after a long investigation, after so many people have been so badly hurt, after not looking at the other side, where a lot of bad things happened, a lot of horrible things happened, a lot of very bad things happened for our country, it was just announced there was no collusion with Russia, the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. There was no collusion with Russia. There was no obstruction and none whatsoever. And it was a complete and total exoneration. It's a shame that our country had to go through this. To be honest, it's a shame that your president has had to go through this before I even got elected. It began. And it began illegally. And hopefully somebody's going to look at the other side. This was an illegal takedown that failed. And hopefully somebody's going to be looking at the other side. So it's complete exoneration, no collusion, no obstruction. Thank you very much. Thank you.
U.S. President Donald Trump. Residents are bunkered down in Western Australia's northwest as Cyclone Veronica lashes the region. The system is unusually large and slow moving, and it's bringing heavy rain, which is likely to lead to major flooding. Authorities are warning that Veronica's destructive winds will last much longer than those of a normal cyclone. Eliza Borello reports.
Destructive winds and heavy rain have not let up on the Pilbara coast this weekend. Roebourne, where Gary Bailey lives, has come in for special attention, with the core of the system hovering over the town late yesterday.
These are very, very strong winds. I've seen the building across the road from us, which is called the Ramara building. The roof is lifting on the corner. I've also seen the dongas that are at the back of the caravan park. There's a few there that have lifted the roofs by the looks. And a lot of them at the moment, mainly tree damage.
Marshall Smith is an Aboriginal pastor from the nearby Five Mile community.
It's been kind of constant, really shady and darkish sort of weather. I've got to say, it's nothing compared to when Chloe came in 1984.
But a lot's changed since 1984. This time, the Smith family was tracking the storm's every move online. And at one point, the information the Bureau of Meteorology issued was wrong.
I'd say it was a glitch, yeah, for sure.
During a cyclone, the Weather Bureau works on the science and briefs emergency services, who then decide where to issue community alerts. The Bureau then puts the combined advice on its website. But according to the Bureau, at one point on Saturday night, WA's Department of Fire and Emergency Services sent through two lots of alert advice, one to be released at 6 o'clock and one at 9. Steve Duggan from the Bureau says somehow the information was combined and meant some towns, including Roebourne, were put on the highest alert, red, 3 hours early.
We acknowledge the impact of that an early going through a red alert early can have on the community. We're well aware of the what the conditions mean in a red alert. So it was an oversight of ours, and we tried to rectify it as quickly as possible, but we do acknowledge the impact and are sorry for those who are potentially inconvenienced by it.
Unlike many other cyclones, Veronica has moved slowly, meaning many Pilbara residents have been forced to remain in their homes for more than 24 hours. At lunchtime yesterday, the WA Premier, Mark McGowan, urged them to be patient.
This is a serious cyclone. People in that part of the world are used to cyclones, but this one is different. It's large, it's slow moving, it will hang around for some time yet. before it dissipates. So sit tight.
As he bunkered down for the night, Gary Bailey was hoping dawn would deliver relief.
Just hope everybody is safe in the morning and it passes without a lot of damage.
That's Roebourne resident Gary Bailey ending Eliza Borrello's report. And our reporter Catherine Diss is in the Pilbara mining town of Port Hedland. Catherine, it's very early there right now, but do you know how communities in the eye of the storm fared overnight?
Good morning, Sabra. Well, yeah, as you mentioned, it is still very early here and the red alert does remain in place, which makes it very difficult for authorities to get any idea of what's going on outside. And given a significant number of people did choose to evacuate, Sabra, authorities are saying they're getting fewer reports than normal. So they're going to head out this morning and hopefully be able to assess the damage once the red alert is lifted. The eye of the storm isn't actually the most damaging part of the cyclone. The most intense part is actually the core or the outer ring of the system. And that's what we've been feeling for the past sort of couple of days. That is the strong winds and the heavy rain. Wim Creek and Roebourne further down the coast from us are closest to the eye of the system, but authorities don't really have a lot of visibility over those communities. They're most likely feeling, though, the effects of what we are here in Port Hedland. That's lots of rain and destructive winds, around 160 kilometres an hour.
Catherine, the system is still hovering pretty close to the coast. Is the worst over?
The eye of this system is currently sitting offshore, Sabra. It's been lingering there and moving very slowly, almost not at all during the night, which is why we've continued to be hammered by the heavy rain and strong winds throughout the night, and it has made it quite difficult to sleep. I spoke to the Bureau this morning and they're now thinking the eye might not pass the coast at all. It could just move offshore again. Veronica has since dropped to a Category 2 system and will continue to weaken from now. Although it is expected to continue weakening, there could be widespread flooding due to the heavy rainfall we are experiencing here, and authorities are expecting it will cause some road closures and cut off some communities.
Catherine Diss in Port Hedland, thank you very much for that update. In Britain, infighting over Brexit within the Tory party has reached fever pitch and furious cabinet ministers are reportedly urging Theresa May to resign. For now, Mrs. May's very few remaining allies are adamant that she's not quitting. The parliament is running out of time to agree on a Brexit compromise, as Europe correspondent Bridget Brennan reports.
Retreating to a 16th century manor house for tea and biscuits sounds like an ideal afternoon in the British countryside, except when you're in the middle of a full-blown political crisis like Brexit. Theresa May called weekend crisis talks at her country house Chequers after reports her colleagues are urging her to quit.
Everybody knows now that the Prime Minister's departure from number 10 is absolutely guaranteed.
Brexiteer and Conservative MP Nigel Evans predicts May's time as Prime Minister is coming to an end.
What is not guaranteed is her legacy, and that is what Theresa May now ought to be thinking about. Does she want to go down as the Prime Minister who failed to deliver on the largest mandate that the people have ever given a government in a referendum?
While an estimated 1 million people marched through London at the weekend demanding another referendum on Brexit, senior Conservatives were plotting a coup. The Times reports that up to 11 cabinet ministers want Mrs. May to stand down. Former Tory leader Ian Duncan-Smith is horrified.
She has at least the right and the dignity, they owe her that, not to behave like they've behaved today. I think round the country, in the Conservative Party and outside the Conservative Party, there'll be real disgust at the behaviour of some of our cabinet ministers who are not fit for their positions if they behave like this. They should be apologising and they should shut up, for God's sake, because that's the worst thing we want.
With a cabinet divided over Brexit, there's not a clear replacement for the position of Prime Minister. Some reports suggest Mrs. May's ally David Lidington was one name put forward, but he doesn't seem interested in the top job.
One thing that working closely with the Prime Minister does is cure you completely of any lingering shred of ambition to want to do that task. I have an absolute admiration for the way she's going about it.
Labour, which has its own woes over Brexit, is being pressed to make its position clearer on the push for a second referendum. The opposition's Brexit spokesman is Keir Starmer.
Can you guarantee that there will be another referendum on a deal if Labour come into power? Well, that's a question, Andrew, for the manifesto.
No, is the short answer.
But let me be as clear as I can. We had a manifesto commitment last time in 2017 setting out the sort of deal we'd negotiate. You know, in the event of an impasse, we'd have a public vote. Yeah. I would expect our manifesto to build on those commitments.
Mrs May was forced to ask the EU for an extension on Brexit last week, and the deal she negotiated with European leaders has been rejected twice. It remains unclear whether she'll put it back to the Commons for a vote this week. This is Bridget Brennan reporting for AM from London.
Glenys Berejiklian has entered the Liberal Party history books as the first elected female Premier of New South Wales and the first to deliver a third term in office for the party in nearly 50 years. The federal government's hoping the winning touch rubs off, as it's expected the Prime Minister will visit Government House within a fortnight to call an election. But while Ms Berejiklian triumphed, there's discontent west of the divide, with the National Party copping a shellacking. The Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party have won three seats in the New South Wales lower house and one in the upper. Prue Goward was a minister in the last Berejiklian government. She retired at this election, but she represented the rural seat of Goulburn for 12 years and was a minister for Family and Community Services. And she joins us now. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Sabra.
How significant is Glenys Berejiklian's win?
Oh, for the reasons that you've said, you know, the first woman to have actually won an election and for the Liberal Party, it means an opportunity to have 12 years in a row. Of course, the other significance is that this term we will see the completion of those extraordinary building projects in Sydney and indeed in the bush, because a third of the capital works budget was to be spent in the bush. And you will see all of those projects finished in this term, which gives her and the party, and indeed even the National Party, a huge platform to leap off into for the next election in another 4 years.
You've been a politician for 12 years, a federal political reporter for many years. How has politics changed over that time?
Well, I think the role of social media means that messaging is much more undisciplined and much more difficult for MPs. The role of Facebook and the trolls and the way it's done and the immoderate way it's often done, they are all traps for young players, and it has to be handled well. You can't do it on your own, so you have to have a really good team in a way that the traditional local MP was very much on their own. I think the second issue, of course, is the role of the local member being well known. The days when you could, and I think that last Saturday's election results showed this, the days when you could just plonk somebody in a seat because they tick factional boxes or they suit the leader of the day's idea about what a local member is, without them having any merit, without them having connections to the area or knowledge of the issues that electorate is facing, are well over. Because if you don't have that, you get punished. A local member every election now is really a series of by-elections, and you have to have a strong local member with strong name identification or name ID that can be built, and you also have to have people of merit, which is why you can't, as I say, just keep going for the same old. You need to look for people who will actually appeal to voters.
In the New South Wales election, particularly west of the divide, people seem to be turning away from the major parties, particularly the Nationals. Why?
Yeah. Look, I think it's a very interesting division between country and city. And
it's a worry, you know, though, isn't it?
Well, it's going to make it much more complicated, because what's happened out west is that, in a sense, the electorates have gone right. They've gone right of us. They've rejected that sort of careful balancing of the environment and jobs. They are making it very clear this is about their quality of life and their jobs and employment prospects. In the city, of course, you are much more distant from those issues, and you can afford, in some senses, the more luxurious position of caring about environmental values and so on. But that is not the case out there. And I think the swing on Saturday to the right in the bush says we want jobs, but we also want plain speaking. I watched, because I stood on booths for 2 weeks and then I stood on a booth all day Saturday. I watched the people taking the One Nation and the Shooters and Fishers votes. In my electorate, it was about 10% for both. And those people were often unemployed. I could see they weren't particularly well educated. They felt disenfranchised. Out there in those seats where the Shooters and Fishers actually won, it was a more pronounced effect. But it's about the same thing. It's about us saying we understand your primary issue is you want a job, you want a quality of life, you want to stay living in the bush, and you want to be spoken to plainly. The amount of verbiage that has crept into politics is shocking when you think about it. We don't talk about people or issues now being difficult or tough. We don't actually nail what it is about that issue that's made it controversial because you don't want to upset anybody. So we talk about challenging problems. And I think that what they said on Saturday is, we want you to speak to us. We want you to speak to us in plain terms, and we want to make your position, you to make your position clear, and we want to understand that you understand us.
The ramifications for the federal coalition?
Well, I think exactly that, that they've got to start, well, both parties have actually got to start talking to people plainly. It's an issue.
So stop the spin.
And people, I mean, Australians have a fantastic nose for a fake. They can smell spin at 50 metres. And I think Saturday said, we don't want the spin. We don't want the on this hand, on the other hand. We just want it plainly. What do you want to do? And do you understand my life and how I need a job? I need to stay living in my local area. I don't want to see my kids going to Sydney or going to Canberra for work and never coming home.
Prigard, on that note, thank you for talking to AM and good luck with life post-politics.
Thank you, Sabra.
The so-called Medi-Scare campaign was front and centre of the last federal election campaign, and Labor's trying to make Medicare an issue at the coming poll, expected to be called within weeks. Labor's promising to end the remaining freeze on Medicare rebates by July if it wins the election. The opposition leader, Bill Shorten, will announce today plans to end the remaining freeze for 100 GP items, including family counselling and urgent after-hours care. Both the major parties are ramping up their policy announcements ahead of next week's federal budget. For more, I'm joined now by our political reporter, Alexandra Beach. And Alex, the Coalition had announced back in 2017 that it was winding back the Medicare rebate freeze. What is the difference with this Labor announcement?
So, Sabra, Labor basically says the government's thawing process is taking too long. It was a Labor government that did first freeze Medicare items back in 2013 as part of a budget savings program. That was supposed to be temporary, but the freeze was then extended by the coalition in 2014 and 2016. At this point, it's budgeted to keep going until July 2020, but Bill Shorten will announce that if Labor wins power, indexation of benefits will resume this July. Now, a big part of the problem in dealing with this freeze previously has been the cost. Labor's announcement today would cost the budget $213 million, but the Shadow Health Minister, Catherine King, says it needs to happen quickly.
So it was a very, very slow thaw. There still remains 100 items that will be frozen. They're things like mental health care, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health checks, family counselling, urgent after-hours care. All of those remain frozen until 2020. We're saying, as an act of good faith, we need to get this freeze well and truly done. We're going to, if we get elected in those first 50 days, get the freeze off completely.
Okay. Alex, it's all very well to say we'll get the freeze off quickly. How will Labor actually ensure that this is passed on to patients and that GPs don't actually pocket the difference?
Yes. Well, the freeze has been in place for quite a few years now. Many doctors have changed their business models to adapt to it, and Labor is planning more announcements over coming weeks about making those GP visits more affordable. But regardless of that, Catherine King has acknowledged that actually getting GPs to pass on this change could be tricky.
Well, that's the challenge. I mean, the damage that's been done, you've seen billing behaviour really change with GPs. People are being charged more. They're not being bulk billed for every single service that they have or every visit that they have. I think it is unlikely that doctors will change, but you know, we are saying to doctors, we're going to get rid of the freeze. We know that this has caused enormous damage to general practice across the entire system. But more importantly, it has created damage to patients. We'd encourage them to pass it on.
That's the Shadow Health Minister, Catherine King. Alex, Medicare is an issue that played very well for Labor in the last federal election campaign. Does this announcement mean a return of the so-called Medi-Scare campaign?
So that Mediscare campaign claimed the government was going to sell Medicare, and it cost the government a few seats at the last election. In this year's election campaign, Labor's planning to focus on Scott Morrison's record on health when he was the Treasurer, particularly claims that he made cuts to services. On the other hand, the government is also making a health announcement of its own today, an $80 million boost for a cancer centre in Melbourne. And we know the Coalition still has about $500 million up its sleeve to spend on health projects that haven't been announced yet over the course of the election campaign, things like hospital infrastructure and research. So we are going to hear a lot about health from both parties over coming weeks.
Reporter Alexandra Beach. So much has been made recently about major resource companies taking climate change seriously and scaling back their investment intentions on fossil fuels like coal and oil. But a survey out this morning says 22 big companies trading on the stock exchange are ignoring warnings from investors and are planning strategies based on the failure of the Paris Climate Agreement to reduce global warming. The survey from the Environment Group Market Forces has been slammed by top businessman Rob Milner, who says that if anything, investment in coal needs to be ramped up to meet demand and keep prices low. Here's the ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
It's taken warnings from regulators like the Reserve Bank and superannuation funds worried about the material risks of climate change. But recently, big resource companies like the global coal giant Glencore have put climate change front and centre of their strategies. But this morning, the environmental finance group Market Forces says 22 companies in the ASX 300 are ignoring the investor jitters about the reality of fossil fuel exposure, instead pressing ahead with strategies that bet on the scenario that the Paris Climate Agreement will fail.
They're either expanding the scale of the fossil fuel industry or pinning their business strategies to scenarios that rely on the failure of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, thumbing their noses at investors and at regulators who have been calling for years for them to start managing climate risk properly.
Market Forces Executive Director Julian Vincent says those companies worth $121 billion need to be divesting rather than ramping up their fossil fuel investments, outing giants like New Hope, Whitehaven Coal and Washington H. Soul Pattinson is out of line and out of time.
The investors that we're talking about are largely Australia's major super funds. They're invested in these companies on our behalf. We know that the vast majority of Australians are concerned they want to see climate change action, and yet they are forcibly being invested into companies that are actively undermining efforts to keep a lid on global warming. Do we really want to have our retirement savings invested in companies that are trying to deliver a future we don't really want to retire into? Because investors will want to engage companies, but if they try through engagement to change a company's behaviour and that company turns around and basically says, up yours, we're going a different direction, then it's going to make their engagement effort look pretty meek if there's no consequence to that.
What sort of response have you had when you raise these climate issues with the companies on behalf of investors?
One of the companies on this list, Washington H. Soul Pattinson, which is a major owner of New Hope Coal, they were questioned about climate risk and the chairman, Robert Milner, says, well, if you don't like what we're doing, shareholders can sell their shares. As simple as that. And funnily enough, earlier this year, the Norwegian pension fund did sell their shares in Washington H. Soul Pattinson because they are pursuing a fossil fuel divestment program at the moment. So with a lot of them, there's still an enormous amount of recalcitrance.
Well, obviously everybody's concerned about what's happening in the world, and we're doing the right thing.
Rob Milner, Washington H. Soul Pattinson chairman, is one of Australia's wealthiest businessmen, and he makes no apologies for making lots of money from digging up coal.
No, Australian coal is very clean and there's 14% of the world still hasn't got power. I think a lot of these people have got to realise that.
But what's your response to an environmental finance group like Market Forces that comes out and says that companies that you chair are actively betting that the Paris Agreement will fail?
Now, we're not betting on anything, but coal is the cheapest form of power.
And so what's your response to environmental groups who are saying, you know, you need to get out of coal, you need to respond to the demands from your investors?
Everybody's entitled to their point of view, but if people don't like owning New Hope shares or watching H.R. Pattinson shares, sell them.
And you see coal as playing a major part in Australia's future?
I don't see it playing a major part, but it's going to be a part. Renewables have got a part. Gas has got a part. Coal's got a part.
So for now, coal remains a big money spinner, with Washington H. Soul Pattinson's first half profit up almost 23% to $179 million, with investors reaping an increased dividend for the 21st year in a row.
The ABC Senior Business Correspondent, Peter Ryan. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipier.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we are from The Signal. It's the ABC's daily news and current affairs podcast.
So, all things considered, things went pretty well for the coalition in the New South Wales election this weekend.
Yeah, so does that mean that Scott Morrison, with his own election around the corner, can relax?
I think the only real thing you can say is New South Wales isn't going to be a critical state in the federal election.
Right, so not really.
Nope. So today on The Signal, we're looking at all the things he should be worried about.
That's The Signal. You can find us every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.